this is awful. God, I don't know if this is a Rotary Club out there or what. I can't. Hi, I'm Bob Earl. I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic. This is really a production, isn't it? Holy Christ. A little room backstage with some fruit and a stage manager. And, hey, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Okay. I'm here to talk about the drugs part now. Well, here he is. Here's that son of a bitch who's going to be 26 years sober next month who's trying to destroy AA. If they could just shut him up, everything would be okay. Sound familiar? Little dysfunctional. Silence. Denial. Keep the family secret. I'm here to talk about what the bottle is the symptom of. I don't know what it went like for you in early sobriety, but those lights are really awful. I would be more comfortable with those off and the house lights on, but, you know. God, all right. Rich, you have no idea if you haven't been. You can see nothing. Black right here. That's it. You know, everybody just, the little voices out there, you know. And I'm nuts enough, right, without a lot of little voices in the dark. You know, I'll just start to twitch up here before it's over. I don't know what early sobriety was like for you, but for me it was interesting because, you know, I would read a line in the book, like the bottle is a symptom of greater lying illness, greater illness. I don't even remember the line now. So you go to somebody, you know, a sage who's been sober a long time, sitting there with their 30 years of sobriety and their bag of Oreos and their pack of Marlboros and their thermos of coffee in case the Alano Club should run out. Of course, we're not addicted to anything else. It's just, I don't know. I hadn't planned on starting so warmly, but what the hell. So I would say, okay, symptom of what stuff? Well, you know, kid, stuff. Yeah, what stuff? Deep stuff. How deep? You'll know when you find it. Have you found it? John, how are you? I need to talk. You know, and they're gone, right? And then after about 10 years, they sort of stopped discussing that. It's like that just kind of drifted into the fog. And then what would happen is somebody would be sitting there 3-4 years sober at a meeting and nuts. Completely nuts. Not even close to sane, okay? Muscle twitches, chewing on the edge of the table, you know, everything going, you know, everything going that could go. And, of course, someone newer to the program would become concerned looking at someone 4 years, you know, like that. And they would say to a sage, what's wrong with him? And the sage would say, well, he's suffering from the ism. So I now, 10 years sober, would go up to said sage and say, what's the ism? Because I was getting crazier as each day went by, see? But there's like a conspiracy of silence. Nobody's talking about being nuts, right? Everybody's okay. How are you, Bob? I'm fine. Thanks. How are you, John? I'm fine. Thanks. So, I kept wondering what the ism was and what the deeper stuff was. I found it. I found it after I was 17 years sober, and my life never looked better. I was writing for television. I was a staff writer on a hit show. I lived in a penthouse apartment at the beach. I drove a brand new Cadillac. I was in the middle of divorcing a beautiful wife, living with a lovely girlfriend, roller skating on the boardwalk. I mean, it was all laid out. Mega bucks coming in, everything was great. A circuit speaker. Couldn't find my ass with both hands in a windstorm, but that wasn't important, you know. Little charisma and people with no self-esteem will listen to anything, you know. So I had all this stuff going for me, and every day, all I wanted to find was somewhere to lay down and die. And it was not funny anymore. 17 years, man, of a lot of days coming up that I just wanted to lay down and die. Now, before I go on with this and really ruin somebody's evening, I can tell you how to make this a really energetic night, if you'd like. I mean, if all else fails, take everything I say personal. What I'm about to talk about up here is my experience and my opinion. That's it. My experience and my opinion. Now, in a functional unit of people, there's room for more than one opinion. You can have 30 people in one room. All 30 people can hold a different opinion, and nobody has to be wrong. Nobody has to be wrong. And if someone has an opinion that differs from yours, it doesn't mean that you're being attacked, and it doesn't mean that it's a threat. It just means that one human being sees things a little differently than you see things. So understand, I'm only here to tell you my side of it. If it gets you crazy, you know, it'll get you crazy. And it may get you crazy. And if you are a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a fundamentalist, a traditionalist, a by the book as interpreted in the 1980s, which is not the same book that I read, but it's okay with me, this may talk may really get you nuts. But I was taught that, I heard a speaker say one time that their responsibility was to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. So if you're comfortable tonight. So anyhow, at 17 years sober and wanting to die, somebody suggested to me, Bob, perhaps you should go see a therapist. Because I had tried everything else. I didn't need anybody telling me to work a step. I had worked them a number of times. Didn't need anybody telling me to write an inventory. I had written 32 inventories. Didn't need anybody telling me to work with a newcomer. I probably was sponsoring about 75 guys at the time that I caved in. Didn't need anybody to tell me to go back to the institutions I came from. I'd been doing that for years. I used to put on 40,000 miles a year, just miles to institutions and meetings to carry the message of AA. So I didn't need any of the party line bullshit. I'd done it all and was dying. It was that simple. I'd done it all and I was dying. Well, I'd always been very open-minded to therapy, although it's permitted in the big book, although you may not get that same message from your home group. It does quite say clearly, you know, go seek out anything you need. And all we're really talking about here is finding the tools that you need for your recovery. And I'm talking about finding the tools that I needed for my recovery and what transpired as a result of this. So whenever anybody I sponsored came to me and said they were going to therapy, I fired them immediately as a baby. I was always open-minded about stuff like that. And the interesting thing was, I thought I was being a smart ass and I was telling the truth, because I'd look at these poor guys and I'd say, oh, okay, obviously AA and I as your sponsor are not enough. I suggest you go find another sponsor. What I didn't realize is I was telling the guy the truth. How his interpretation and his ability to work the program and my sponsorship was not enough. That person needed more tools. Everybody gets crazy when you mention the word therapy. For Christ's sakes, does anybody read any of our material? Does anybody understand it? That from 1937 on, Bill was in therapy for most of his recovery? I mean, do we, you know, what happened here? This organization was founded by guys, man, who were movers and shakers. These guys were seekers, for Christ's sakes.
they were trying every new thing that came down the pike. You know, they used to hold seances at Dr. Bob's house, for Christ's sakes.
This is your founders, guys. I mean, for those of you that are a little stiff about this program. Remember, your founders used to sit there by candlelight with tables raising. Okay? We have no idea how much of this program came from the other side. I know there's a book in the works right now by one of the most precise research people I've ever met in my life, and this book is about the great channeled writings of the last 200 years, works that have been sent to us from the other side. Seth Speaks, Course of Miracles, on and on and on, and listed right in the middle of all of them are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But we won't take that one on right now. We'll go on someplace else. I feel great, so I feel really good. I didn't think I was going to feel good. Usually when I try and, you know, get on the plane, get there the same day and change and everything, some shirts travel better than others, if you hadn't noticed. I thought I'd be really beat, but anyway, I feel great. So anyway, I was so desperate, I went to see a therapist, and this woman looked at me, and she said, tell me a little bit, start with your childhood and tell me a little bit about yourself. And I said, well, when I was 15 years old, they threw me out of Manual Arts High School in Los Angeles. I had discovered the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol. I spent the next 11 years running the streets, drinking alcohol, using drugs, smuggling drugs. And then I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, and I've been clean and sober for 17 years. And she looked at me with this strange expression, and she said, well, I said, start with your childhood. You weren't born when you were 15. I said, I don't remember anything. She got this great smile, you know. And I interpreted the smile as she saw megabucks coming in, right? If he can't remember anything, he's mine forever, you know? And then I decided it already looked like she had money, so I figured what I was going to give her was notoriety. She figured by the time she got done writing a paper on me, she'd get the credit that she deserved all these years she was working in this field. Anyway, we went to work. We went about finding out what happened to me when I was a kid. Now, as I stand here tonight, almost 26 years sober, a few days away, or 30 days away, or whatever the hell it is. When is it? No, it's about 2 months, I guess. I am thoroughly convinced that what lays back in there in those unforgotten childhoods is the ism. What lays back there in those unforgotten or those unremembered childhoods is what they talked about in the big book when they said the bottle is but a symptom of a deeper lying thing. Because what I've unearthed by going back there are issues that existed long before I ever took the first drug or long before I ever drank the first drink. That's the sense of that something was wrong with me. That's the sense that I was a bad kid. That's the sense that I'm no good. It's the beatings handed out to children who don't deserve to be beaten. It's the withholding of love. It's love being used as a bartering tool. There's a cardinal rule in all alcoholic and in the majority of alcoholic and dysfunctional families. And that rule is this: if you love me, you'll never be in conflict with me. Whoa. Sound like your home group? Human conflict is perfectly normal. See, what I've uncovered is stuff like this, and I'm real current on this one, okay? I was born with a full set of feelings. God delivered me here with a full set of feelings. Now, I know this is very accurate because I have a 5-month-old baby daughter at home, okay? This little girl arrived with all her feelings intact. One of the main things she has is an ability to express her needs. Okay? And one of the myths that I have heard and perceived in 12-step recovery is that recovered means not needy. Okay? But there's something wrong with that, because emotionally healthy means knowing what my needs are and being able to get them met. Well, my daughter has arrived, knowing her needs and being able to see that they get met. Okay? And she gets this, and she has degrees. I mean, it's like, if it is a minor need, it's a minor little... It's a little bigger need, it's more of a... You know, if it's a bigger need... And then she can get up there, you know, if it's something like, all right, quit fucking around, I've had enough. It's time to fix it now. Boy, I'm telling you, the cats run, the dog gets under the bed, you know, it is... Well, now, if there was more honesty, as I perceive it, in 12-step recovery, quite often, more than half of the group would walk in at night, and the minute they hit the door, they would go... Now, she can also get mad. Anger came with her. Uh-oh. Because there's a rule in alcoholic and dysfunctional families that says, if you get angry at me, I will withhold my love from you. Whoa. This little kid can get so mad. She tightens up her little hands. They're so tight, they turn purple. And she starts to scream. And she tightens every muscle in her body, and she frowns and furrows her brow. And she turns red as a goddamn fire engine and starts yelling. And this one spot right here is white because she's cut off all circulation to this one spot just because she's angry. Okay. So she arrived with all this stuff. I arrived with all this stuff. What the hell happened to mine? Man, by the time I hit 12-step recovery, I was feeling nothing. How do you feel, Bob? I think that things are all right. Yeah? What do you mean, feel? Feel what? I'm all right. Everything's here. What the hell you want from me? Now, the interesting thing about this is, out of all the people I've heard discuss their first encounter with chemicals, alcohol or drugs, it always went something like this. It made me feel taller. It made me feel handsome. It made me feel pretty. It made me feel sexy. It made me feel tough. Made me feel happy. Made me feel funny. It made me feel okay. So, I've never yet heard anybody, I'm sure there are people, but in the time I've been around, everybody I've ever heard talk about their first encounter with that chemical, whatever it was, it somehow altered their feelings. It did something for them. Yet I never hear discussions about feelings. And I see people starting to express feelings, and I see them get abused. I see people start to grieve over things they've lost, and I watch them get attacked for self-pity. Oh, give me a break here. I got a lot of things to be sad about. You know, I got a ton of stuff to be sad about. Okay, or I get mad. Somebody offends me. I'm angry. Turn it over, Bob. The major avoidance phrase of the 20th century. I know this is upsetting some of you, but stick with me to the end. It gets worse. No. Maybe you'll understand what I'm trying to say, and maybe you won't. It's okay. I just know that there's an awful lot of people in 12-step recovery in pain and don't know why. And that's all I'm trying to say is I was in tremendous pain in 12-step recovery, and I found out why. And so I want to share that. I'm sick and goddamn people say, oh, boy, he's after AA. His son of a bitch doesn't like AA at all. He's trying to tear it apart. Horseshit. Give me a break, will you? I don't know anybody puts more energy into this outfit than I do, for Christ's sakes, you know? And certainly, if you think I didn't have anything to do, so I thought I'd come talk about topics that are going to piss off 70% of an audience. I mean, I may like abuse, okay, but, you know, it's not that much. I get sick and tired of going to conferences, and when they have the sobriety countdown, it breaks my goddamn heart that over 50% of the people there are sober less than 3 years. That makes me sad. I want to know, where the hell are the rest of them? Where's all the people, 6, 7, 8, 9? Where do they go? Where have they been all these years? Where's all the means that came through the goddamn door? What happened to them? I'll tell you what happened to them. I have a friend, 10 years sober, man, couldn't look at these issues, just blew his brains out 2 weeks ago. I've been talking to him for 3 months about this stuff. He'd get around to it as soon as he straightened out a few other things. And he finally straightened it out. And that makes me sad. Also makes me lose my place. Where was I? Well, okay, feelings. I have come to this conclusion. Feelings are who I am. Okay? That's who I am. And I arrived at this conclusion by figuring out what I'm not. I'm not my car. I mean, I can go out and it can be gone, and I'm still going to be here, stuck, right? Without it, so... Bob's still here. Car's gone. Bob's still here. Okay. I'm not my clothes. Same thing. You know, clothes disappear, stolen. I'm still here. Bob's still here. I'm not my house. I mean, my house can burn to the goddamn ground, and I'm going to be there standing in the ashes, still here. You know, looking for something. Some part of my identity. There's got to be something here. Jesus, somewhere. This is it. I'm not my job. I mean, that could be gone Tuesday, and I'm still going to be here. I'm not my body. You can cut my arm off tonight, man. I can lose it. I'm still going to be around. In fact, it's not uncommon at all that people that lose an extremity or two, you know, a leg or two, both legs, or an arm or both arms, suddenly find out who they are. And suddenly life takes on a whole different meaning. And they come forth with feelings and courage and ideas and inventiveness and creativity that they never knew they had. Because they suddenly found out what they weren't, you know, which is not this thing. So you go through this, and I'm not my mate, because I've gone through God knows a series of them trying to find out who I was. If you don't know who the hell you are, it's really difficult to have a meaningful relationship with anybody, you know. Because you don't know who's there, all right? And number two is if you are, I had major problems with women. One problem I had was that I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I was the only child, and I played all the roles that children play when you have a big family. But my primary role in my house was that of the lost child or the ghost, a little kid who just, man, ain't there, right? Even though he's there, he's not there. And I moved real quietly through my house. This did not change in recovery. I mean, I could be 5 years sober, married, living in a house, and I'd still be sneaking through the goddamn house at night. Very quietly going through the house, not wanting to disturb anybody. And I could do that when I lived alone. I would sneak through my own apartment at night. I would tiptoe out to the refrigerator. I'd open my can of pop with my hand over the top to muffle the... Right? Because I don't want them to wake up. I'm still so terrified of what happened to me when I was small that as a grown man in an apartment by myself, that fear still lingers so deeply and so surrounds me that I can't make a noise. I cannot make a noise. Okay, so I am my feelings. Well, I don't know that I like that idea. You know what I mean? Because feelings are kind of weird in that they're not controllable. They just sort of come up at inopportune moments. My feelings are not always appropriate to the moment. Everyone may be laughing. I might be crying. I and my neighbor go out of our houses in the morning, and if our cars don't start, we both turn around and come back in our respective homes, and he calls the auto club. He's a functional human being. And I call suicide prevention. Because my life was just ended by a dead battery, you know. I mean, well, feelings require the ability to be spontaneous. I can't be spontaneous because if I'm spontaneous, you're going to find out my biggest secret in the whole world. And that secret is that there's something wrong with me. And that in any situation, anywhere, anytime, under any circumstances, I'm not enough. And nothing I do is ever enough. Now, I may be the only one that knows that, but I know that. And that's my secret. So I can't be walking around here laughing at inopportune moments, crying at inopportune moments. I can't be sitting in a room full of people shedding tears because I'm sad over some apparently little thing to you, but probably big to me. So if I am my feelings, then I better find out what the hell my feelings are all about, or you may say goodbye to me as a recovering person. Because if I am in enough pain long enough, in recovery, I will go back to the only solution I know to that pain. I'm gone. Okay? Goodbye, Charlie. I think getting in touch with your feelings is the number one goal to prevent relapse. Oh. Feelings? I don't want to know about feelings. Well, let me tell you why maybe it's important and how you can get to them with the 12 steps if you want. And if you can get the help. One of my major problems throughout my life was I am afraid of the anger of women. Okay? Not men, women. Very difficult to have a relationship with someone you can't talk to because you're afraid of upsetting them. I have furnished lots of houses, bought lots of cars, lots of clothes. I can remember one time I got married to a flight attendant, and she said, "Guess what? Husbands get to travel for 90% off, too." I said, "Oh, great. God, what a dowry that is." And yet, in the spring, when she was in Paris buying her fall wardrobe, I was home writing to earn the money, because I was afraid if I went, she'd get mad. Now, none of this had anything to do with her. She hadn't said anything. This was all going on inside of me, okay? I'm just terrified of the anger of women. And I'm a kind of lunatic 4 years sober. Man, you might find me standing in the middle of your hood in an intersection trying to discuss your driving with you, you know? Now, if a woman got out of the car, I'd be backpedaling. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, if a guy got out, it'd be more like, well, let's see if you and I have been to the same places, you know, because one of us is going to get hurt awful bad here, you know. And that was kind of how I lived my life. And I would take an inventory. I would go to a sponsor, and I'd have on my inventory, I would say to my sponsor, "Well, I backed my wife's car into a pole and dented it, and I lied to her and told her it got hit while it was parked, and I wasn't there. And my sponsor, meaning well and not knowing any better, would say to me, the party line, 'Bob, you're in recovery now. And in recovery, we must stop lying. It's no longer an acceptable method of behavior. I go, okay. I also have just been really effectively shamed. I've also just been made ashamed of who I am and how I behave. So, having done such a thorough job of getting to the exact nature, I would be back next year with another wife, another car, and another dent. Same to another sponsor. I backed my wife's car into a pole. I must have had a thing about backing their cars into poles. It must have been the only, you know, way I could get even with them for all the shit I couldn't say. You know. Sorry, darling. Somebody hit it. I have no idea. So I say I backed my wife's car into a pole, and I lied to my wife and told her it got hit in the parking lot and I wasn't there. And then one more time, man, same thing. Bob, you're in recovery now. We must stop lying. It's no longer an acceptable motive. One more time, man. I walk out ashamed, you know. Got to stop lying. Book says exact nature. Fearless and searching. Exact nature. Let me take you to the exact nature in my life and show you how it goes. Come to sponsor and say, backed wife's car into pole, dented it, lied to her, told her it got hit when I wasn't around. Well, Bob, why do you think you lied to her about the car being dented?
I don't know, man. You know, I just...
Well, Bob, you must have had a reason. Something motivated you to lie rather than tell her that you had an accident, meaning something unplanned with her car.
Yeah, well, I know, probably, yeah, so big fucking deal, all right? So I just didn't want to tell her that I dented her car.
Well, why didn't you want to tell her you dented her?
Well, God, you know, because she would have been mad at me for denting her car.
Yes, she might have been. Anger over having the car backed into a pole would be a very healthy, realistic reaction.
Yeah? Well, I don't want her to get mad, okay?
Well, why don't you want her to get mad, Bob? It would be emotionally healthy for her to get mad.
Well, I just don't want her to get mad, man, you know, because when she gets mad, God damn it, it upsets me. I just don't want her mad, all right?
Why would her anger upset you, Bob? She's 5'2" and weighs 90 pounds. You're 6 feet tall. You weigh 180, for Christ's sakes. Why is this anger upset?
Well, it just makes me, you know, when she gets mad, God damn it, I want to kill her.
Bob, why do you think you feel a need to go to that extreme to stop her anger? Having never thought of homicide as an extreme solution...
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't know. It just really upsets me. I don't want her mad because I want to kill her. Why? Why do you get so... Because I'm afraid.
What are you afraid of? And if we had the time, this man and I, or this helper and I, or this supportive person and I, we would continue to work on that feeling, and we would take that fear and that anger, and we would trace it back until we got back to, this is the truth of what happened to me, and it took me, I was 24 years sober when I made this discovery, okay? From the age of about 1 year or less until 5.5 years of age, I was beaten senseless by my mother. I was beaten so badly, I missed so much school. My first year of school, they wouldn't even give me any grades. Okay? And I can remember asking her one time, how come they didn't give me no grade? Since I missed a lot of school. It was before I was working on these issues. She said, I don't know, maybe you were sick. Handy piece of information. Parents don't forget that. You know, if you miss so much school, you don't get a grade. So I spend most of my adult life terrorized by the anger of women, and I don't know why. You know, but that's the exact nature. I didn't lie about the car because I'm a bad guy. I didn't lie about the car because I'm an inadequate 12-step member. I didn't lie about dating her car because I have a failed spiritual program. I lied about the car because I'm goddamn scared to death of her. And shouldn't be, but I am, and I don't know why. But see, I never could let a female get angry around me because I perceived their anger as a real threat to me. I thought I was going to get hurt. You get mad, and you're a woman, and I perceive I'm going to get hurt. That's all I know. All right. That's the exact nature. Nothing short of that is what it's about. Well, that's got nothing. That certainly happened a hell of a long time before I picked up my first drink. It sure happened a hell of a long time before I, you know, hooked up the first turkey baster of morphine and went for a ride. You know, I mean, it was that sense, that fear, that inadequacy was with me from the time I was this big, man. So back there, hidden in my past, in my childhood, what I couldn't remember were all the secrets, all the exact natures of my behavior in recovery. Well, what did I discover? I discovered that most of us who grow up in an alcoholic or a dysfunctional family are screwed. From the gate, you do not stand a chance. In an alcoholic family, it's bizarre. You know, now if you did grow up in an alcoholic family as opposed to a dysfunctional family, and you reached that point in your life where suddenly you've worked the steps as good as you can, you've gone to 164 meetings a week, you're sponsoring 345 people, you carry 17 panels, you serve on 4 boards in 4 counties for intergroup, and you're running for trustee at large of AA. And you want to die. And somebody says to you, well, maybe the reason you want to die so bad is hidden back there in that childhood. If you're from an alcoholic family, you got a little better shot at accepting that, pardon me, than if you're from a dysfunctional family. The reason is this. Those of us that grew up in alcoholic families, no matter how hard they tried to cover it up, there were little things going on that weren't quite okay. You know what I mean? I mean, I remember coming in from playing baseball, having a bat and a glove. I couldn't have been 5 years old, man. And I come in and I open the closet door, and here in the closet is my old man, right? Standing there, glassy-eyed, peeing on the shoes, you know. Right? Now, in my very short time on this earth, I had not seen any of the other kids' dads in the closets peeing on the shoes, right? So, no matter how hard my mother tried to tell me about the fact that he had the flu and it had infected it had affected his inner ear, and thereby thrown off his balance and sense of direction, which is why he had gone in the closet instead of the bathroom, there was some little voice said, not true. She's lying. Now, the flip side is, if you got the alcoholic mom, right, you come home, she's passed out, her head is in the dryer, she looks like she's been guillotined, okay? And the rap you're going to get is,
she's tired from working so hard, taking care of you, you little ungrateful son of a bitch.
Now, I don't even want to get into the psychological ramifications of giving that, of empowering a child with that belief over, about power they don't have.
You'll be the death of me yet.
You're the reason your father drinks. Yeah, I mean, you know, give us a break, will you? Okay. So if I go back to look at my alcoholic family, the minute I say, somebody says, maybe it's in your past, a couple of those little incidents will come up, you know? My dad taking me to the ball game, 8 years old. I'm in downtown Los Angeles. He's drunk and he's lost. And I don't know where I am or where to go. And I'm like, you know, I remember that one. And I remember the closet, right? But if you're from a dysfunctional family, and you're wondering why you're so screwed up, and particularly if you are the chemically addicted child, or what they call in the professional circles, the acting out child, okay? Listen, we owe a lot of gratitude to the acting out children. They're the ones that drew attention to the fact that it's the family that's fucked up, not just the one that's, you know. A lot of it came from facilities working with adolescents. They get them shaped up, send them back to the family. 2 months later, they'd be back. You know, eventually somebody said, I think we should look at the family here. You know, we keep sending this kid home and he's not too bad and he keeps coming back, you know, gone. But if you've got a dysfunctional family, you look back at a dysfunctional family, it looks good. It looks great. Christ, everybody in the neighborhood loved them. They were the pillars of the church. I don't even want to get into that one, okay? Let us say that there's a lot of information in that says rigidity is bad for children. Okay? Rigidity does not work. All right? The human being, okay, is not designed for rigidity. Christ, ask Jimmy Swaggart. You know? Ask Baker. It didn't work. All right? If you try and be that rigid and suppress what you are as a human being, it will come seeping out through the cracks in inappropriate behavior. Sit down, shut up, and listen. You don't know anything, don't say anything for 90 goddamn days. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth.
Children should be seen and not heard.
By the way, none of that horse shit's written any place in the book.
It just sort of appeared one day. I wonder from where.
No, no, don't applaud. They'll look for you, you know. They'll. I get to leave town. I'm okay. You just sit quiet. Don't let them know you agree. Dysfunctional families, workaholic father, kids 3 years old chasing the guy at the gas station. Daddy, daddy, has no idea what daddy looks like, right? Daddy, 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 you know, and then he's told, your father isn't home because he works so hard, because he loves you so much to provide all these things for you.
Let me share something with you that they have discovered about children. Children do not hear the words. They feel the feelings. Children do not hear the words. They feel the feelings. So, even if your mother is standing there saying to you, I love you, you're the most wonderful child in the whole world. But mother is thinking the following. If I had not got knocked up by your old man in that goddamn Chevy, I wouldn't be stuck in this suburban fucking toilet I'm in. With all these people I can't stand, going to goddamn PTA meetings with idiots, I'd be in the Caribbean laying on the beach having a mad sexual affair with a 15-year-old beach boy. The kid does not hear, I love you. The child does not hear, I love you. The child reacts off of feelings. I know now that I was being beaten in order to be made to stop crying. You know, to stop me from crying, I was being beaten. Okay. It comes out between me and my baby daughter. She starts crying, gets going, and I have a clock built in. And as a period of time goes by, about 6 minutes, and my clock goes off and says, okay, that's enough. You've expressed yourself. You can stop now. You know, this is all internal in me. But she's not stopping now because she's not done. So she continues to cry. See? And so now I'm upset. Now I'm ready to use her for a basketball, man. And I am absolutely, totally opposed to any kind of violence. I do not believe that children should be struck under any circumstances for any reason in their lives ever, and spend as much time as I can working to stop the abuse of children, okay? But I got this little girl in my arms, man, and I got a lot of old stuff still around from a lot of old beatings that I got, and I can no longer let her cry because I'm nuts. I'm not going to let her pick up that energy, so I take and hand her to my wife and say, here, you know, get up, love her, because I can't. I don't have to pretend that I'm some kind of goddamn saint and the perfect father, you know, people. Because I had a lot of people waiting around saying, well, wait till a baby comes. We'll see if he really knows anything about any of this stuff, you know. So I give her to my wife. And if my wife is also nuts at the same point, we call up this lovely little marvelous Hispanic lady who takes care of her. We have her come over to the house and we give the baby to her, right? We say, here, you take her, right? And she, who is not fucked up over everything like we are, carries her around the house, sings to her in Spanish. She grins. You know, she loves it. And she's not picking up all this nutso energy off two children who were beaten senseless when they were small by their parents. It's part of being who I am, a part of knowing what's going on. But I know that she gets the energy. I feel my daughter, our daughter, has a wonderful chance. My wife's been in therapy about 12 years. I've been in about 8. She's 13 years sober. I'm 26 years sober. We've been working on these issues a long time, man. We believe emotionally this girl's got a shot. Genetically? You know, we're realists. We're going to put aside a bail bond fund before we put aside a college fund. You know. There's a distinct possibility somebody may offer her a beer, you know. And if she ain't feeling great when she gets it, you know, here we go. There is a term being used by professionals today which sums up the personality, the addiction, the trait, the illness, the whatever label they hang on it, as to adults who were raised in alcoholic and dysfunctional families, and they call us codependent personalities. It's a very offensive term to Al-Anon. They hate it. I just spoke at an Al-Anon, state Al-Anon conference in Ohio. You think it goes bad for me at an AA conference? You know. I don't understand people. They don't have a sense of humor about this stuff, you know? I said little things like, perhaps your recovery will start when you ask yourself, why didn't you rescue the children? Why didn't you get the children out? And the answer to that lies in their childhood. It lies in their childhood. Why didn't you get the children out? Don't tell me you loved the man. What about the babies?
Why didn't get up? See, this stuff, man, I feel the energy. And this stuff just turns and twists and upsets and makes your butt tighten up. You know, it just, you know, it makes you mad at me. I'm not doing nothing except telling you about what happened to me and what I've discovered. You know, you can go out and ignore it all. Ignore it all.
If you want.
Anyway, here's a problem that, and I'm not saying you are, but I am a codependent personality. I just use the label to keep it simple so I don't have to use 175 words and always keep saying adult children are alcoholic, dysfunctional. You know, I can just say, okay.
We have a real problem in that the growth in others is perceived by us as a threat.
Whoa.
We have relationship difficulties because I have a friend in back where I live who just recently went to his wife. They have a huge home, right? And he said, I just want some closet space to myself. I want my closet. Get your stuff out of my closet.
She hears, next week we're getting a divorce. Okay? I already have no value as a person. I already can't figure out what the hell you're doing with me in the first place. I already probably don't even like you because you're with me. Because I wouldn't be with me, you know, if I had any choice. I'd move, right? So these are all my feelings going on inside of me. I can't, and you go to do something for your own benefit, and I see it as a threat. I perceive it as a threat. Codependent personalities perceive any change in the norm as a threat. You know, it's like, if you try and work on these issues, you may experience the loss of a lot of friends in your family. The family does not get excited when you go back and say, I got a couple of questions. You know? What happened to me? They probably won't tell you. Okay, so where does AA fit in all this? Where is he going? What the hell is this guy talking about?
When I arrived at the doorsteps of Alcoholics Anonymous, alcohol and drugs were my number one problem. They were killing me. And for everybody, for the Al-Anon and the alcoholic, when you come into these programs, you know, there's that miracle, there's that moment, there is that beauty, there's that time. It's when somebody answers the phone on the other end. It's when the two guys show up at the house and say, come with me, man. There's some place that you're going to be okay. Or two women show up and take you and make you feel pretty again and make you feel okay. There is that moment. There is that miracle. There is that beautiful goddamn moment of, whoa, there's hope for me. I am, and after a little few days, a few weeks, a few months, there's like a frosting that goes on that cake that says, wow, I am so grateful to be sober. I am so grateful to not be drinking and not be taking drugs. And I owe a credible debt of thanks to AA, to the meetings, the big book, to my sponsor, to God. Okay. But came a day in my life where being grateful for being sober was no longer enough. It wasn't holding me together anymore. All right? So, what I've discovered is this. AA for me is like this lectern here. It's like a table. And when I was a small child, my parents just, I was like this perfect little picture puzzle delivered here by God. And my parents took this picture puzzle and they broke it into 500 pieces, man, and they scattered this picture puzzle all over the place. Okay? Now, Drugs and alcohol are no longer my number one problem. Drugs and alcohol haven't been my number one problem for a long time. The thought of drinking alcohol or taking drugs as a solution to a problem probably hasn't entered my mind in 15 years. It doesn't even come up. It's so far away, it's not even an issue. I could no more tell my story now without going to sleep than the man in the moon. I mean, you know, so what I now am doing, I'm going out there and I'm getting other tools so I can put this picture puzzle, me, back together. And AA is the table, man, on which I'm putting this puzzle together. Without this table, I can't put the goddamn puzzle together. But the table by itself, by and of itself, for me, is not enough. And I know that's like, now I'm just saying me. It may be okay for you, for Christ's sakes. But because it's okay for you and not for me, doesn't make either one of us wrong. You don't have to see it my way, and I don't have to see it your way. Let me tell you something about emotional good health. If I am okay with me, I have no need to make you wrong. So sure, a lot of what I say may sound like heresy and it may threaten it. It may absolutely scare you to goddamn death. When I was first sober, I had old crime partners of mine cleaning up in some, I can't even remember the name of it now, some fundamentalist church movement for junkies in East L.A. And they came and got me and said, hey, you got to come see this thing with me, man. It's great, you know. And I went up there, gave my soul to Jesus Christ. I didn't even have any withdrawal, first time in my life. I went, sat down and ate dinner 5 minutes after the service. It's fucking wonderful, right? I said, I ain't going. It's working for you? I ain't going. Because my nature, my personality is such, if your thing works, I perceive it as a threat to my thing. Well, that's not realistic, but it's what I perceive. So I couldn't go look at their thing for about 3 years until I was a little more secure with my thing. And then once I got a little more secure with my thing, I said, well, let's go see what they got going on down there. I went down there and said, hey, okay, Teen Challenge it was called. That's what it was. And I said, okay, it works. So what I'm trying to say is this. If you've done the very best job that you know how to do, let me hit on another one. Let me do another one. I was trying to put a deal together with some guys here not long ago, and it involved a lot of money. And they were not living up to their end of the deal. They weren't returning goddamn phone calls when they were supposed to return phone calls. They did not show up for a meeting they were supposed to show up for. And I was getting really angry. You know, I was like, Jesus, I'm making my phone calls. I'm calling when I'm supposed to call. How the hell come you're not calling, right? And I'm getting mad. Anger is a dubious luxury of normal men. I think they were talking about suppression of anger. Not expression of anger. I think I knew a little better than that. Okay? So, anyway, then I get a phone call, and somebody who had just had a business meeting with these guys tells me I'm in the middle of doing a book, and it tells me that these guys are afraid that I might write some stuff in this book. And I was hurt, really hurt, that they would even think that of me. And I hung up the phone, and I looked at my wife, and I started to cry. I said, God, you know, they're not making the meetings when they're supposed to. They're not making the phone calls when they're supposed to. And now the son of a bitches think that I would do that. I mean, it really hurts my feelings. And I'm sitting there with my wife and I'm crying because my feelings are hurt. Because I'm a more honorable person than that. And these guys should goddamn know that, you know. I mean, people may accuse me of a lot of stuff around here, but I'll tell you one thing, I am. I'm honorable. And I'm not afraid to tell you who I am and what I'm about. And then go home, right? And it'll change tomorrow. But that's, and I don't have time to communicate that to you. So now I can think of 175 well-known people that I know in this 12-step recovery program who fly everywhere telling us all how to work it. And I bet you goddamn dollars to donuts if I called every one of them and said, these guys aren't making the meetings. They made me mad. They've hurt my feelings by saying this, that I'd get the fucking party line, turn it over.
I don't need to turn it over. I'm a human being here, God damn it. They're not living up to their end of the deal, for Christ's sakes. They've said something awful. It hurt my feelings. I'll tell you what I did. I got up the next morning, got on the phone. First thing, when I knew they'd be in the office, got them both on the phone. I said, okay, look, I want to tell you a couple of things. And we're talking, this deal is involving, you know, a few grand, right? I said, look, I first of all understand I don't care at this point if this deal goes through or sinks. I said, secondly, I want to tell you, I'm really mad. You haven't made the meetings. You haven't kept the phone calls when you were supposed to keep the phone calls. And thirdly, I want to tell you how bad you hurt my feelings. And I felt so terrible, I started to cry. Now, I'm on the phone with these two businessmen in this other state, right, in tears. In tears. Because my feelings are hurt. Man, they really hurt me. And I said, you have really hurt me by saying that to somebody else and believing that I could do it. Because I'm not that way. And then I said, you know, we'll talk when we talk. And thanks for hearing me out. And I hung up. Then I turned it over. I'm a live human being here, man. I don't have to walk around. So, like, I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which has got 3 Zen Buddhist temples. Woohoo! Repression is repression. I don't care what fucking label it comes under, right? Boy, these guys scare me, man. I don't ever want to be around one of them when there's a loud noise. You know what I mean? They're just too quiet. Just...
Everything is as you perceive it to be.
Well, I perceive it to be horse shit, goddammit!
I tried that stuff, you know, I thought I could get to take a shortcut, get to God, soar like an eagle, you know, with the rest of the spiritual giants. Major problem, my navigational system was prepared by my parents. I kept flying into the sides of buildings from my past. Yeah. Oh, watch Bob go. Also, it's very dangerous for those of us who are adult children. Any kind of meditation that splits you off, takes you away from yourself. I love that. Well, roll my eyes back in my head and go. Hey, great. Yeah, gone, man. You know, I was sit down there at Self-Realization Fellowship by the lake and come back in 3 days. You know, just disappear. Leaving is not my problem. Being here with this guy is my problem. See? I'm the last person in the world I want to be with. And yet my whole recovery depends on me. Doesn't depend on you. Doesn't depend on the big book. Doesn't depend on God. Depends on me, see? And I got to believe that God wants me to express all these feelings. Otherwise, why the hell did he give them to me in the first place? You know, if God is so powerful... If God is so powerful, so wonderful, and so loving... Then why am I a human being if he doesn't want me to be a human being? And human beings are wall-to-wall feelings. And you want to hear another problem adult children have? A higher power. Turn it over, son. To who? Well, turn it over to God, son. Who's God? God is a power that loves you, son. Perceive God as your father who loves you. I'm screwed. You know. I'm done, man. I'm going home knowing I'm in real trouble. Real trouble. And I better get good quick or God's going to get me. So, what is this guy talking about? What I'm trying to say is if you've done the best job you can with everything in your life and you still hurt like hell... Maybe the solutions lie in that real dark, murky area back there called your childhood. And I'll tell you what does lie back there for a lot of us. A lot of sadness and a lot of pain and a lot of anger. Rage so bad, when some of this stuff came up, if my parents had been handy, I probably would have killed them. Or certainly wanted to. But I had to get through that.
See, forgiveness, then everybody says, well, you've got to forgive them. Forgiveness is not an intellectual concept. Forgiveness does not take place in the mind. Avoidance takes place in the mind. Feeling takes place, forgiveness takes place in the heart. I can't get to this heart until I get through all the pain and stuff that it's covered up with. Okay? So, as a result of going out there and getting the tools I've had to get, improving my nutrition and what I eat, eliminating cigarettes and caffeine and sugar and, well, not completely salt, and not completely grease. Those are really my favorite. Salt and grease, I just...
Even today, I was still, I did this about a week ago. You know, it's amazing. I will walk in a goddamn supermarket, and it's just like this big hand comes out of the aisle and takes me to the nut section, you know? Right? And screw all the health nuts in the bags, right? I go right past them till I find that can of Planters cashews. In oil and salt. Oil is another word for grease, okay? And I, honest to God, will buy this can telling myself still today that I'm going to take this can home and eat a half a dozen nuts. Put the little plastic lid on it. And have some tomorrow night. You know, an hour later, I've got a ring around my face, you know. For trying to lick the salt and grease out of the bottom of the can. So I had to work on my nutritional habits a little bit. I had to learn how to exercise so I can use up some of the energy that I would normally use for anxiety. I had to find out how to trace these feelings back through the repression into my childhood. Now, a lot of people, what happens is, see, the number one problem of adults who were raised in alcoholic homes or dysfunctional homes is that either A, we are not in touch with our feelings at all, or B, if we are, we don't know how to express them to others. Now, I'm one of the lucky ones, I think. I wasn't in touch with mine. God, I would hate to think how awful it would be to know what they are and not be able to tell somebody. I mean, to know what you feel and not be able to tell somebody what you feel. So these are the problems for adult children. Well, a lot of people will get completely frustrated, or what happens is a sober member of AA will quit smoking, and he will soon find himself at an ACA meeting. Reason being, no one will tolerate his behavior anyplace else, right? Nicotine and tar, major suppression of anger. I mean, anger is the number one thing that it holds down, which is why everybody goes off the fucking end when they quit smoking, right?
Martha, I hate that goddamn green couch.
But Fred, that green couch has been there for 20 years.
I know, and I've hated it for 20 years.
Fred, perhaps you should have a cigarette. Change is perceived as a threat. Okay? So, an alcoholic quits smoking, goes to an ACA meeting, walks in the room, and this is usually what they will tell you after they have been to their first ACA meeting, if they managed to stay till it was over. Those are the sickest goddamn people I have ever seen in my life. I have never seen anything like it. I mean, they're pounding on the tables and crying and sobbing. For Christ's sakes, they live in the problem. Nobody talks about the solution.
Let me try and clarify something for you if I can. And this is a recognized problem of adult children. If my problem is that I am not in touch with my feelings or can't express my feelings, if I am in a room containing other people and I am angry and pounding on the table, or I am sad and hurt and I am crying, I am in recovery. It is only in dysfunctional families that the open expression of feelings is considered nutso. So, 9 years ago, I wanted to die. 9 years ago, I wanted to die more than I ever wanted to die in my life. It's 9 years later. I've learned about running and bicycling and good nutrition. I've learned about all forms of exercise. I've learned about yoga. I don't smoke anymore. I've gone back and gone through 9 years of pain, man, of shoveling through that childhood and finding out the beatings and all that went on, and the fact that they couldn't buy me shoes that fit. And today my right foot's practically a club foot. It rolls over because they made me wear shoes that were too small for me. They had to spend the money on alcohol. I've had to go back and dig up all that pain and cry about it and yell about it and scream about it and pound on couches. So here it is 9 years later, man. And today there is a very terrific human being here. Right? I'm okay with who I am today. I can get on a phone and tell businessmen in a deal involving thousands and thousands of dollars that I'm sorry you made me mad, you hurt my feelings, and I'm going to cry in front of you just to show you how strong I am. And it's okay with me. I walk by a window sometimes today and I'll get a glimpse of myself and I'll smile because I like this man who's there. I've met this little child who lives inside of me. And I want to tell you something. He's terrific. Now, he didn't like me when he first met me. He didn't trust me when he first met me. And he was really angry over the fact that I have continued to do to this child inside of me for about 40 years or 50 years, everything that my parents did to him. And he wasn't thrilled. But I was very afraid of this child. You know why I was afraid of this child? I intuitively knew that if I ever hooked up with that kid inside of me, my life was going to change. And I'll tell you why it changes. My life changed because children will not let another child go without food to eat. Children will not let another child go without a place to live. Children will never, under any circumstances, let another child be beaten without telling somebody. Children will take a blanket down and give it to somebody, to the homeless. They don't care if they look cool or don't look cool. If they got one blanket, they'll go share it. And I knew when I met this kid, my life was going to change. And my life has changed because I care about these issues now. And then I care about children. So, to the children inside of each one of you in this room, I want to say this. Be patient. The big person inside who you live will eventually, by emotional pain and recovery, be forced to look for you. And my prayer is that they find you. God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.